Some people might get the community rights, and some people might get the economy right, and some people might get the scaling right, some people might get the art and the gameplay right, but I think putting it all together is great, where the magic happens.
Welcome to Layer Zero. Layer Zero is a podcast of unscripted conversations with the people that make up the Ethereum community. Crypto is built by code, but it's composed by people, and each individual member of the crypto community has their own story to tell. The cypherpunks understood that the code they write impacts the people that use it, and Layer Zero focuses on the people behind the code, because Ethereum is people all the way down, and it always has been. Today, we are speaking with Jiho from Axie Infinity, and Axie Infinity might be one of the first organizations that knowingly is calling them a nation, and really, really fits that model. And I really think the Axie Nation is the right way to understand what Axie is trying to do. And so that makes Jiho one of the first core community leaders of the Axie Nation, has a very interesting vantage point as to how to view communities growing around Web3. I think, as we all know, like, all things in Web3 all have communities around them. Everything that tends to work tends to also have its own community. And so we discuss how the Axie community has grown, the ways that it has shaped over the years in its various sizes as Axie has progressed through its development. We talk a ton about what the metaverse is, what it means, why people like it, and how it will be shaped in the future. And also just some other fun facts and tidbits about Jiho, which I don't think you would get anywhere else. So let's go and start talking to Jiho right after we get to some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible. When you shop for plane tickets, you probably use Kayak, Expedia, or Google to compare ticket prices. So why would you limit yourself to just one exchange when you trade crypto? When you make your trades, you want to make sure you're getting the best possible price on your trade, and that's why you should be using Matcha. Matcha has smart order routing that splits your trade across all the various liquidity sources in Ethereum, and is also operational on Polygon, Avalanche, Binance Smart Chain, and other chains. Trading on Matcha is super easy because it pools the liquidity for me in a single, easy-to-use platform and allows me to make limit on-chain orders, so you can set and forget your DeFi trades and they will go through automatically while you're away. So when you're making a trade, head over to matcha.xyz/bankless and connect your wallet to start getting the best prices and most liquidity when you trade your crypto assets. Slingshot is a decentralized trading platform that combines the performance and ease of a centralized exchange with the openness and transparency of DeFi. Slingshot aggregates liquidity from all of DeFi in order to find the best price on thousands of crypto assets. Every token on Slingshot comes with a price chart and trade logs to give you insights into the market's activity in real time. Slingshot is available on Polygon, Arbitrum, and Optimism, saving you from the high gas fees and low transaction fees of the Ethereum L1. There are no fees to trade on Slingshot, and any positive slippage is given to the users. Trading on Slingshot is a social experience. You can even set your chat avatar to your favorite NFT, or soon, a Slingshot 2099 NFT avatar. Once you bridge your assets to Polygon, Arbitrum, or Optimism, go to app.slingshot.finance to trade and use the chat box to share your trades with others and find other tokens to ape into. Bankless is proud to be sponsored by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum that lets you trade any token at the current market price. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. The Uniswap Grants Program is accepting applications for grants. Do you have something of value that you think you want to contribute to the Uniswap ecosystem? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a unique grant at uniswapgrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. Hey, Jiho. How's it going?
Hey, David. Yeah, doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Where are you in the world right now?
I am in Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah? Do you live there? You don't live there, do you?
I'm staying here for a bit. I got stuck here after Metaverso, and you know, just have a lot of work, so didn't want to stop traveling. So,
well, Puerto Rico is not a bad place to get stuck at. So that must be a vibe. There's a lot of crypto people down there. Anybody from Axie?
Yeah, there are some Axie community members down here, for sure. We play basketball, go to the gym together.
Well, I'm sure you have Axie friends all over the world. So no matter where you get stuck at, you can probably find some members of the Axie Nation wherever you live.
Yeah, that's one of the best parts of the community.
So where'd you grow up? Let's go back to just like your formative years. Where'd you grow up in the world?
So I was born in New York and I grew up there for the most part.
Grew up gaming.
So I grew up as a gamer, as a collector. My dad's an interesting guy. He's a polymath man, so he has like so many different interests. So he owned a gallery as a painter. He collects insects and fossils. So he's really into like moths and butterflies. He's actually an attorney as kind of as for his profession. So he's kind of like doing a lot of different stuff. My mom is Korean. She's like a typical tiger mom. She was super strict. So I was always right like trying to play games. She was always trying to get me not to play games. My cousins are Korean. I'm half Korean. So Jiho is actually my name, my Korean name. And my cousins would bring over like StarCraft, Diablo, World of Warcraft. It's kind of how I got into gaming a bit. Whatever game I played, my entire school ended up playing. For some reason, I was like the curator. And yeah, so I got really into gaming as a kid. I was an only child, so I think like I was, just keeping myself occupied and trying, kind of right in the early days, right? Like StarCraft, that was the first thing I ever did on the internet, and you could actually kind of socialize from your bedroom as a kid. My mom sent me to boarding school because I was way too into WoW, vanilla WoW. And that's basically why I left New York, went to New Hampshire. Yeah.
These are all Blizzard games. Is that a coincidence, or what's up with that?
Those are, I think, a lot of the games that really defined me, I think, happened to be Blizzard games. I was also really into Donkey Kong Country, like during the Super Nintendo game days. Zelda, like Ocarina of Time, I think I played through maybe 20 plus times. Obviously, Pokemon. I still have my Pokemon collection from when I was a kid. I was an early adopter. I didn't know at the time, right? But I have a bunch of like first editions and Shadowless that I was just collecting as a kid because I wanted them. Like I would sell shark's teeth and my drawings and stuff like that to scrounge up enough. And yeah, apparently my collection's worth quite a bit now, which is crazy because like that was all, just collected by me as a kid without too much capital.
And you was it to play the actual Pokemon card game, or was it more about the collection?
It was more about the flex, I think, and just I have this collector's instinct, right, where I just there's some things that I just need, right? And I think it's similar to my dad. I think it's genetic. I think I inherited it from my father, right? Where my dad has cases on cases of butterflies. I think he has like around 40,000 insects that he keeps in our house. So I think I just have that collector's gene. So I got really into I played Pokemon on Game Boy, but in terms of the card game, I was an only child, so I didn't have anyone to play against me. So I would just collect them. I was always like that was right. Those were in the days of kind of right. It's like if you wanted to play with other people, they had to like kind of come over to your house or whatever. So people would come over to hang out, but most of the time I was just by myself. Like I was one of the kids that bought two Game Boys so I could trade with myself, my red and blue version, so I could get the 150. Right, you couldn't get one. That was one of the be a genius aspects of Pokemon is you needed right, like you couldn't get all 150, in classic right, in the classic versions unless you actually right like somehow traded with someone who had the other version of the game. I guess like the loophole was that you could just be both people.
Did you ever complete your Pokédex?
I think I had 150.
Yeah. Which was your starter? What was your starter Pokémon?
I picked Charmander. I like reptiles. Like I grew up having lizards and I guess salamanders are not reptiles, like amphibians, but yeah, like I always had frogs, salamanders, reptiles, snakes, turtles.
So you pick the yeah, right, gotta pick the fire reptile. You said that you were like the trendsetter for your school's games. I want to unpack that a little bit. How'd that happen? Like, why was it a coincidence, or was it just you had the energy about the games that you liked and that ended up being enough? What was there?
It's strange where right, like yeah, I would, I just wanted people to play with me, or like with Diablo, like I would get people and right, I was like, I wanted people to trade with on amicable terms, or to kind of, to kind of farm for me. I would gear them up and, say, hey, get me, send me some stuff later, once you're up and running. So yeah, I don't know. I think I was just really into it, and I think also it was like my cousins were really, they're Korean. They were like really kind of ahead of the curve. They would get like the new Blizzard game as soon as it came out. So for some reason, I was always the one who would get this stuff first. And also, right, it was like also, I think my birthday was right around like where like, you know, games would launch. So I would always, you know, get whatever for my birthday and try to spread it to the rest of school so I had people to play with. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a winter birthday?
Yeah, February, early February.
Yeah, okay. That's pretty cool, cuz like actually we'll go into that later. You're kind of a charismatic dude. So when you come to school with your games that you want to talk about, were you like a school socialite? Like did you like to just share stuff with other people and just happen to be games, or like what was your role in with your friends in school?
It varied over time, but I think like if you ask my, like, it's hard for me to, you know, comment on that, but if you ask my mom will say that, you know, everyone for some reason, all the boys or whatever, like wanted you know, to be my friend for some reason. They would try to like impress me by playing games. I don't know what it was about, but
do you see any of that still being true in your time at Axie now?
I don't know. Like, I mean, I think, right, like,
you have an entire continent wanting to play with you at the moment.
Yeah, thinking back, right, it's like it should have been obvious that I think I could be a good, you know, a person to evangelize a game, to spread a game. It's, you know, it's come more into focus as things have progressed. So yeah, it's been a crazy journey. And, you know, I never would have dreamed that I would be, you know, involved in gaming as a profession. I didn't know what I want to do with my life for most of my life, right? So it's only within the last 4 years or so that I've really, felt like I've found my calling.
Did you ever have like a entrepreneurial spirit as a kid, or is that also relatively new?
I think I was. So I was, you know, selling shark's teeth. I sold candy in my lunchroom.
Shark's teeth, like we're talking about actual shark's teeth.
Yeah, fossil shark's teeth. Like fossil shark's teeth, like 10 million. Because my dad, we would collect fossils on the weekend, and he would, you know, he would let me take, you know, the ones that weren't perfect and sell them to the kids. So yeah, I was all, you know, I was kind of artistic as a kid too. I was, you know, selling my drawings. I would sell my drawings and paintings to anyone that came into my house, like my mom's friends, my tutor, people who came over to my dad's, who came over to look at my dad's collection. So, yeah, you know, I think like I think I'm a people pleaser. So I think like, right, like also giving people what they want and right, having like some kind of beneficial two-way transaction, I think makes me happy.
So it wasn't out of like a drive to save up for something that you wanted to purchase. It was more about like the transaction itself.
I think really like there's a social element of it, but then obviously, yeah, like, you know, I always was saving up for something, right? My Shadowless Charizard, I saved up, you know, a while to be able to buy it. I think I paid 15 bucks or maybe 15 to 25 bucks. I think they're worth like 15K now.
Oh my God.
So I saved up for a while for that. I would create, my mom would, and I would actually create my own reward structures as well, where it was like, oh, if I do something good, I'll get a marble. And then if I get 10 marbles, my mom would give me like $10 or buy me a toy or something like that. So I was just interested in that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I would say I was a relatively entrepreneurial kid. I think that there are more entrepreneurial kids out there. But yeah, you know, I had a little bit of that in me.
That sounds a little bit of a incentive gamification that you impose upon yourself by your mom. Is that sound about right?
Yeah, I would create the incentive structures that my mom would use to keep me behaved. Yeah,
and then of course, naturally, this just lends itself into game economics design later, right? Like, is that a direct one-to-one comparison, or am I reaching for something here?
Yeah, I think there's some parallel there. Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you feel like you've enjoyed that so much? Like, most kids don't want to impose rules upon themselves.
I think it was like I wanted something, and I wanted I wanted like a clear path towards getting it. So yeah, it was kind of like negotiation strategy, I think, with my mom as well. Where,
Let's see. Do you think like do you like the sense of achievement? Was that about it? Like, you know, victory unlocked.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I think I do like transparent reward systems, I think. I tend to think about that a lot with, right, Axie, you know, not just within the game, you know, the game economy. I have like a, you know, I would say, you know, relatively small role with, but also, you know, the creators and the community and how everyone kind of aligns incentives with each other, for sure. I find it fascinating, right? I think that's actually, right, like my understanding of Web3, because I come, you know, I don't come from a technical background, right? I come from a gaming background, the collector's background, right? So for me, right, like the huge unlock that I see with Web3 is, you know, figuring out how to align incentives and create these kind of sustainable economic engines to these open source technologies. And that's like a lot of, you know, how I'm looking at the space right now.
So for the onlooker, the people that aren't like diving into Axie Infinity every single day and kind of just like knows that it exists and that it's extremely vibrant, your role in Axie kind of just looks like this great community manager, like this great community leader who's just like part of just like injecting vibes and energy into the community. Would you, A, do you agree with that take? And then B, if you, for somebody that would like to actually peer deeper into the scenes, what do you actually do?
Sure. So I think that's fair. So I actually come from the community, which some people might not realize or remember in many cases. So, right, like I discovered Axie just like a lot of people, just like much earlier, right, where I was one of the first, I don't know, a couple hundred people in the Discord. It was very small. There were around, you know, maybe 5 to 10 people there to kind of welcome me and walk me through. And, you know, I was super excited about it because, right, like I was an early CryptoKitty community member, right? And there was this notion like, hey, like, you know, we need to be able to do more with these things. So it's not just about breeding and selling them, right? Like there has to be some emotional value. There has to be something fun that we can do. So it's not just us dumping cats on each other, right? So we kind of, you know, there was a little bit of that already that the space kind of understood. And, you know, so I fell in love with the art and the fact that there was, this roadmap towards a playable game that seemed achievable, you know, that really resonated with me. So I just started, you know, I just came in and started doing all the things that I thought I could help with, right? So, like, you know, helped write the original white paper. I started doing a lot of the announcements and, you know, yeah, community building, right? Where in the early days, I was doing unscalable things, like getting to know everyone in the community, sharing the vision repeatedly so people understand, like, you know, what we're building and why. I think like a lot of that is still applicable today where, I do a lot of stuff around the community and the economy. I think it's very interlinked, right? Because, right, ultimately, what creates this sustainable economic engine is, right, that people are spending, right, for fun or for status within the ecosystem, right? That's what's kind of subsidizing, right, the economy and this ability for people to actually earn.
Was it as simple as just understanding Axie to be CryptoKitties but with a game, or was there extra, you know, magic sauce that compelled you in addition to that?
Yeah, I think that was part of it, right? Like, we were just iterating, right? Like, I think a lot of it was, some people saw Axie as a fork of CryptoKitties, right? Like, the marketplace contract is very similar. The breeding contract is very similar. And, right, a lot of the early community members, right, like, you know, kind of gave up on CryptoKitties and came over to Axie. So, right, there was a little bit of that. Yeah, a lot of the people who got it immediately were like, hey, like, there was 3 weeks where we could breed CryptoKitties and actually make money, right? Like, how could this, you know, potentially last forever? So I think a lot of the people who were thinking through that framework were actually able to understand Axie, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then was it in equal parts of like the fun of the game and or with the tokenomics, the breeding, or were you actually thinking like, oh, this is actually a really fun game, I'm excited to play this? Or was it more about just like, oh, there's this fun like weird breeding economic system behind it? Like, was it both, or was one really compelling?
I think it was a combination, right? Like, yeah, the idea that, right, like, you would actually need to spend time in game to earn the right to breed. I think that was like, right, like one thing that just locked into place and seemed to make sense, right? Where you could basically, right, like, the problem with CryptoKitties was there's just a hyperinflation because people could just, like, you know, keep breeding at will. Whereas, right, the idea that, okay, if you actually sunk human time, effort, and skill to earn the right to be able to breed, right, this would, you know, act as a way to basically, right, back each Axie with real human time and effort. So I think that was a lot of it, right? And then, yeah, people were – part of it was just the community. Like, people were willing to help. People understood that this was a community-driven thing. They were really helpful. They were making awesome memes. They were making awesome – you know, there were we had some initial early video content creators and stuff like that. So there's awesome art. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it was a combination, right, of the community and the art. And what promised to, you know, what was looking like it would be a pretty fun game.
So I want to unpack. There's so many things I want to unpack. I want to unpack first off the community aspect of it, because isn't also, even though it's Axie is like, it's more than a community, because the size of it is so incredibly large. It's like, you guys correctly in my mind call it the Axie Nation, especially because you have your own economy. But isn't the community at the very, very basic level also in competition with each other? Right, like isn't Axie kind of like a race for resources? And so, like, yes, it's very like collaborative, and the Discord is very like community oriented. But also, isn't it competitive too?
There is a lot of, right, at its base level too, right? Like Axie is a, right, like in terms of the current product, is a card battle game where you battle these pets together in PvP battles. There's a leaderboard, right? Mm-hmm. But I think there's also, right, this collaborative spirit, which I think is interesting, right? Like, how do you turn like what's, you know, right now a PvP experience in terms of the gameplay, and why is it so collaborative, right? Because there is, right, this base ownership, right, where everyone owns Axies, right? A lot of people own Axis tokens, right? So yeah, it's right, there's a little bit of competition. I would say friendly competition as well, which kind of creates some camaraderie and bonding. But also, right, there's this PvE component. The PvE component is like everyone in the Axie community against the world who doesn't take us seriously, who thinks that NFT games are never going to work, right? We've always had that kind of underdog chip on our shoulder. And I think it's really important that we maintain that even as we get larger.
Did you just use PvE, where the E is not just the game that you're making, but the whole entire universe? Is that what just did?
I think, right, I think DGen Spartan once talked about that, right? Like life in terms of like PvE, P and PvE. So, yeah.
It's an interesting like tool to rally a community behind, because like there's no better like enemies that exist to rally a community than like the faceless ones, right? And especially the gargantuan faceless ones. Like, oh yeah, like we're going to take on everything. Can you just unpack that a little bit more about the significance? Is that like an idea that you have, or is that more like a codified part of the Axie culture about how like, oh yeah, we're going to take on the world? Or is that just kind of the vibe that you get after you read between the lines?
I think it's maybe half, right? Like, we saw in the early days, right, that the community was kind of rallying against, always, right, had some kind of something or someone to rally against, right? In the early days, we kind of had like this beef with the CryptoKitty community, where they thought, oh, like this is just a CryptoKitty clone, right? They're never going to do anything, right? So yeah, there's always been, I think, right, like, and from the early days we saw that was like, you know, a good strategy. And I think it's also true that, right, like, people, because Axie is so cute, I think they don't take it seriously. And it's like, I think it's just been us proving, right, the doubters and the haters wrong, like month after month, over this journey. And I think, right, that's like part, yeah, it's part, you know, this is part of the fun, I think. I think it's part of our culture. And I think it's also something that, you know, the community leaders, not just myself, right, community leaders understand is an effective strategy for getting everyone on the same page.
I want to keep going down this thread, but there's a question I have that I think if I don't ask it now, I might lose it. And that is, a lot of the games that I play, like Diablo, both 2 and 3 included, Borderlands comes to mind. A lot of these games end up all in the same state, which is like grinding. And me personally, that's kind of when I like tap out of the game. It's like, okay, I will go through level 0 through like 99, but once I'm at 99, like, I'm out. Like, I'm done with the game. Like, I don't want to grind the same things over and over and over again. Have you guys thought about this at Axie? And how have you, like, kept people engaged post-grind? Like, once you get to the grinding stage, how do you keep people entertained?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, right, like, the fact that you have ownership of the things that you're grinding for, I think, you know, helps, right? Where you can potentially, right, convert it into something that's helping you in real life. I think that all games with staying power have, right, like, basically had interesting social elements to the ecosystem where, right, with WoW guilds, right? There are people who play WoW, not because they find WoW enjoying, but because all their friends that they've met online are playing WoW. So it's like, if they quit WoW, they're going to lose all their friends, right? So the social systems are really important. And yeah, I think like, right, with Axie, right, it's like people, they love being part of the community. They love learning about Web3. There's always something fun to look forward to, right? Like we're constantly iterating and building new experiences on top of the axes, right? Like the current product is actually our second version of the battle system. We're coming out with the third version of the battle system. So everyone's like, right, like we have this like when V3 meme, stuff like that, right? And then it's just like we're building out in public. So people feel like they're building together, that they're collaborating together, that that there are these connections. And it's just far more than a game, right? It's a place to have fun, to bond with each other, to flex your crypto kind of extravagance. Axie is rewarding, right? So people come to this topic, right? It's like, is Axie fun? Right. And we've talked to you and I've listened to some of like the thinking from the founder of EVE Online. And right. And he talks about it as like, right, like game, people talk about fun, but actually what games should ultimately strive to be is to be rewarding in the same way that we find our lives rewarding. Right. So if you talk to any random person, right, they might not find their life fun all the time on a day-to-day basis, right? That might not actually even be good, right? Fun is probably a poor thing to optimize for, right? But ultimately, most people find their lives worth living and rewarding through different forms of kind of, I guess, value, if that makes sense. There's, right, there's social, there's economic, right? There's building a legacy, right? And I think the thing about Axie is that it's actually, right, like harnessing this kind of like idea of ikigai, right, where you're people feel like they're part of this movement, they're building something that's substantive and important, and yeah, they're having fun and making friends while doing it.
There's a line that I remember Joe Rogan saying once upon a time, where he was recounting the story of this person that he met that had this like kind of basic like production behind the scenes job at some like live music venue. I don't know, is irrelevant. But just like kind of this normal guy, but he was like in some like insane top 10 tier World of Warcraft player. And like the line that this individual left with Joe Rogan was that I am such a nobody in the real world, but in World of Warcraft, I'm like one of the biggest celebrities. And like Joe Rogan was harping on the fact that the guy was talking about how he's nothing in the real world. And like the contrast that he was giving was like, oh yeah, he gave up his real world identity in form of this like fake World of Warcraft identity. And he just deposited all of his like, you know, mental energy and mental motivation into this fake world, this like this World of Warcraft world. But I think when you take a context of what you just stated, where it's like, no, World of Warcraft's not supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be rewarding. And then also we talk about integrating assets into things like Ethereum, where, you know, there's USDC on Ethereum, which is connected to the Federal Reserve. And how can that be fake? Right. And so like, you know, the assets that you find in your game are just one steps away from being the reserve currency of the world. How can that be fake at all? And so like the takeaway that I just got out from what you just said is that, you know, with games not supposed to be fun, they're supposed to be rewarding. Like we're actually trying to recreate the real world, but in the digital world, right? We are not trying to make the digital world fun. You're trying to make the digital world real.
I think that's also a functioning definition of the metaverse, right?
Is totally
right. This idea that our digital identities, our digital items, our digital experiences and lives are starting to merge and right, like become just as important and just as substantive and rewarding as our lives in the physical world.
Yeah, I think there's a transition happening where like games are no longer just like supposed to just serve you like dopamine on a platter, but they're supposed to serve you emotions of all types, like responsibility, like the things that you would find out in the real world, like loss. I think there's a big component of EVE Online, which is loss, where like you go and you build your ships and then like you get like hijacked by pirates and you lose all of your stuff. Like that's a real emotion that you're going to feel as a result of that. And it's not fun at all, but it's very, very real.
The more the sustainable game economies, right, are going to mimic parts of life that we don't like in interesting ways. And that's also right. It's like as someone who works on games, right, that's something to think about is like, right, like how close to, everyday physical life do you want these games to be? And what is there some hybrid that is like a nice, I think, middle zone that it might be, preferable. So yeah, it's I think that's where a lot of the design space is.
There's another line that I hear also from also on Joe Rogan, but this one came from Elon Musk, where he was talking about why Instagram did better, has got bigger than Twitter. And Elon Musk said it's limbic resonance, as in Instagram resonates with people's like more reptilian brain much better than Twitter does. Twitter makes you think; it makes you like actually use your brain. Instagram doesn't. You just vibe, and Instagram makes you feel emotions. And so maybe the version of the metaverse that delivers reality rather than just dopamine is the one that humans gravitate for, because we're striving for that that same kind of feeling, right? We're striving for that, responsibility, all the things that make us human. And so maybe it's the successful games of the world are the ones that don't just deliver dopamine on a platter, but are the ones that allow people to like deep use their deeper parts of their brain.
Yeah, especially the ones, right? The ones where it's where people feel okay, I think, spending 12 hours a day and right, it can't just be right all pleasure. Speaking of Joe Rogan, we were Joe Rogan Axie was actually mentioned on Joe Rogan
Really?
last week. Like he was looking into it, looking at the website. He had it up, so we were trying to get in touch with him. But that was an amazing moment for the community.
Yeah, I think Joe Rogan's like on the cusp of just like going down a lot of the Web3 rabbit holes, but and everyone wants to talk to Joe Rogan, obviously. But it's just I think it's just going to take one of us to break open the doors. So if it's you guys, congratulations. If that's coming your way, that'd be pretty cool.
It's interesting because right, I think the flow of the conversation was, hey, like, what do you think about Meta, right, and what, Facebook, formerly Facebook, is now doing? And then, right, somehow, right, it's like, right, like rather than showing anything that Meta was doing, they actually showed Axie Infinity. So, if we can be, right, if we can be the poster child of, this new digital revolution that's happening, I think that's going to be awesome for us, for Ethereum, for everyone.
So how did you go from like one of the just the early members inside the Discord to an actual team member?
I just, I showed up and I saw all this work that needed to be done. And I started doing it. In the early days, I didn't get paid. We didn't have money. We didn't have ETH. I was getting paid in Axies initially. Ended up, working out really well. Like, some of those Axies are super rare right now. Just started figuring out, what needed to be done. So a lot of the initial team members, they're Vietnamese, right? Masmune, who's like our artistic genius, Trung, who's like our CEO, he's an engineer. They're Vietnamese, so right, there's a little bit of a language barrier, right? So I thought, hey, like I could come in and just, do some communication, try to build excitement and understanding of how big this could be within the community.
When you saw the potential behind Axie Infinity, did you what in what potential did that forum come in? It's like, oh, there could be a lot of people playing this game, or like, oh, these Axies could be really, really valuable. Like, which one was the one driving you?
Yeah, I think it's a combination, right? Like I think also like the limbic system thing also like resonates because it's like, hey, like these are cute. Like people are gonna like this. This has the chance to really change gaming. We understood that there, right? Like we understood that there are problems with gaming in those early days. I know because right, we wrote the white paper in about February or March of 2018, and we talked about some of the problems in gaming, right? That right, it's, right, like basically, right, in traditional gaming right now, majority of the value is not going to the people that are creating a majority of the value, right? The app stores, the game publishers are taking like north of 50%. So it's not even the game. It's not the money isn't even going to the game developers, right? It's a lot of it is going to these middlemen. So that's why, right? Like, crypto is just like, right? Like, so textbook definition, right? This is not advanced stuff. It's like wherever there are huge extractive middlemen, right? You remove that middleman, and you give it to the builders and the community members. So, right, this is Axie is just that principle, I think, applied to a game.
And I mean, so much of people, so many people must have come into the Axie ecosystem more or less with that mindset or something similar to it, as opposed to like, oh, this is going to make me rich mindset. Because like, while Axie definitely started off the conversation of like, oh, crypto gaming is like a financial opportunity, it didn't start there. So have you noticed since the mooning of the AXS token a difference in the people that come into the Axie Nation? I'm assuming you have.
Right, this is something that I talk to Peter Pan about a lot, right? Is community building in a bull market and community building in a bear market fundamentally different problems? Sometimes require fundamentally different people. But yeah, it's something that we think about a lot, right? Is like, right, you get this, right? Like bear markets, you'll have a small number of missionaries, and then, right, the entire world finds out about you in a bull market, and maybe, right, the cycle repeats, and right, you end up with more missionaries than you did at the end of the last cycle or the beginning of the new cycle. So yeah, it's like nature, right? It's like nature's healing. But yeah, definitely as, right, our audience becomes more mainstream, you start to run into, you know, different types of problems, right? Like, you know, gamers are not super nice as a demographic, right? So you start to have, right, like our you know, your community starts to become closer to like a League of Legends community in some cases, or some of them are start to become like that. But I also think that a lot of them are, you know, able to learn and understand, right, that this is a movement, and a lot of them are receptive to the education. And and that's also why it's important, right? Like, I think a lot of the projects that are trying to copy us, they don't have this like older, right, these veterans who are going to come in and, you know, basically tell the new kids what's up and what this project is really about.
Yeah. Is there like a schism between the OGs and the new members?
Yeah, I would say some of the OGs are a little bit reclusive and hesitant to, you know, engage with the newcomers. There are others that are there, like, you know, that are, you know, more public facing and, you know, think that and prioritize really educating the new faces. But yeah, like just like within any society, right? It's kind of like, oh, like, you know, people come in and, you know, there can be like class. It's like, right? It's almost like class
generations, yeah.
Rivalry, right? And generational rivalry, yeah.
How have you guys had to deal with that? Or is that something that has been like, it's maybe just a small friction? Or is it actually something that you guys have had to address intentionally? Just the differences between the generations.
Yeah, I think empowering people to build bonds. I think like the content creators, like the OG content creators too, right? Like they do a good job because, right, they also, right, like they see them as their followers and stuff like that. So it's something that I think is a difficult kind of phenomenon that's happening, but it's also a luxury in many cases, because a lot of projects they don't have any of that, right? They just have maybe, I don't know, a very small community, and many of them might just be super new and only focused on the token go up. So
I would imagine there's some like dynamic, like tribe dynamic, where you have the village elders and then you have like the punk kids, and the kids want something that the village elders don't, and maybe the village elders know best. But you can't only listen to the village elders, because like you got to also include the punk kids, right?
It's politics. It's politics, right? Like, and it's now like I feel like I'm a politician, right? Like I'm a I have, right, like we have constituents, right? And I think that's what this is. Yeah, it's we're starting to see the rise of these kind of opt-in nations, right? Where it's not like, right, like the management is still, right, like mostly top down. But right, like it's opt-in, right? So if, I think that's what we're starting to see more so than like fully decentralized co-management structures, is right, like you get to choose who your leaders are, which I think, right, is like that right to choose, I think is a key distinction. Yeah, well, and I think we'll also start to see right like more decentralized contribution creation building, and also maybe, yeah, potentially kind of like decision making for the future, the future direction of projects. But I think there's a lot of research and experimentation that's been going on and going into that kind of stuff, and I think like the optimal I think the optimal strategy is also, right, I think Vitalik talks about this, right, is like there are different communities that want different levels of, right, different trade-offs, if that makes sense.
Like the Axie Discord is like the largest Discord in the world, if I'm getting my numbers right. And I would imagine managing that is just an absolute nightmare. And if you call this thing a nation and you're calling what you're doing politics, how are all these different factions organized? Like, is it a representative democracy, or do you have like, you know, the content creators over here, and then you have like the players over here, but then you have like the casual players over here and the advanced players over here, and then you have like the actual builders? Like, how is this nation organized?
Yeah, so our Discord is interesting, right? Because our Discord is actually an interesting example of how we've attempted, at least, to tackle this in the short term, where we actually have a Collabland integration. So you basically, right, Collabland will read your wallet, see what NFTs you have in your Ronin wallet, and then assign you a role, right? So if you have 3 axes, you at least get to speak in the general chat. If you have 10 axes, you might be able to speak in the economy chat, right? If you're a landowner, you get to speak in the land holder chat, right? So yeah, it's kind of, right, we have these, you know, parallel forums for discourse, and then there are people who float among them, and yeah, we have community, you know, moderators and volunteers that kind of, you know, guard dog the Discord, right, where, right, you're trying to make sure that people aren't like misleading people aren't trying to scam the new players and things like that. So it's fascinating. I've spent a lot of my life in Axie Discord, and yeah, I mean, Discord as a product changed my life. I think I actually, yeah, so I am still, I think, the number one like by messages in the Axie Discord with, I think, like, you know, a couple hundred thousand. So.
My God, wow, that's insane. You talked about guard dogs in the Discord, make sure that people aren't scamming people. If we're using a nation metaphor, that feels like the police.
Yeah, it's like more like vigilante justice, I would say. Yeah. Maybe a little bit.
We're trying to
figure out, like, I think this is a question that we think about a lot in conjunction with the rest of the entire ecosystem, is like, right, like, what is the correct level of, like, community, right, like the community driving some initiative and norms within the ecosystem, and, you know, what needs to be kind of like more of a firm, right, you know, something closer to a rule or a law, right?
Right. That's nuts. I can't imagine how tall of an order that is. Do you ever fear that, like, what happens if Discord goes down? Like, Discord has gone down at times. Like, what would the Axie Nation do if Discord, like, died for a week?
Yeah. So I will point out a data point. Our monthly 30-day volume topped out at the same week that we hit the Discord max. Right. So it's like we solved, right? Like, we were able to build this, you know, EVM scaling solution to scale our game to millions of players. And then what's the thing that might be holding us back right now is like the 800,000 cap on a Discord community, right? Because I feel like being a part of the community is such a fundamental part of the experience, that, right, like, you're probably, you know, you're not getting as engaged community members. You're having a lower hard activation rate, right, in terms of, like, I don't know, growth marketing terms, right, without having people actually able to join that main Discord. So I will say that it's interesting, and yeah, like, we're definitely overexposed and overly reliant on Discord. I think it, you know, like, there are some Web3, you know, alternatives that are starting to maybe pop up, but it's still so early. But I do think that is, right, that is the next wave of innovation, I think, right, around, like, basically social coordination tooling, right? So we're starting to see, you know, I don't know, these token gated forums starting to pop up, so which might be like an early iteration of that. They're not quite as real time as Discord, right? Like, the server stuff is, like, you know, it's gonna be hard to get something to that level quickly. And right, there's a reason, I guess, right, that maybe Discord is inherently unscalable, right? Like, why won't they let us hit a million in our Discord, right? It's that must be a very, 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 it must take, like, a lot of, like, server power, right, to keep that thing going.
Totally. Yeah, it's like, if the breaking of Discord while you guys are doing the all-time high in volumes on Ronin is like, well, we actually got Web3 to scale more than Web2. Like, Web2 broke.
It wasn't Web3 that broke. That's the paradox. That was a paradox. I felt like that was interesting. And I think it shows, right, that we're facing a lot of the problems that these NFT games are going to face in a year, 2 years. We're facing them first, and we're gonna have to solve them first for them, for everyone else.
So, as the AXS price just went absolute bonkers, one of the resulting downstream impacts of that is like so much angel investment, seed investment, seed round, startups came as a result of that. Like once you, it kind of felt like, you know, when Bitcoin went from $0 to $1,000, all of a sudden the next thing that happened was that we had like 10,000 Bitcoin forks. Like, now we're kind of seeing the same thing. Like AXS went from like a $3 million market cap, which is basically nothing, to where it is now in the multi-billions. And now after, as a result of this, we have like an infinity number of play to earn games being like invested in right now. Like, if you had to guess, what percentage of those will have any sort of like meaningful adoption? Like 5%?
Yeah, probably like very small number. Yeah. Around like 2 to 5% sounds directionally correct. I think we'll might have to see a lot of consolidation, and this also goes for the guilds, right? We also saw an explosion of funding rounds for guilds for the games. So yeah, we might need to see consolidation around that, and yeah, it's going to be hard for all of them to succeed. But yeah, I think like we'll also may see, right, some important projects come out of this class, right? I think that's, you know, generally how crypto works, right? Where even right Ethereum was, you know, I think funded, you know, by Bitcoin, right? Like that. Mm-hmm. That's how you paid in the ICO, I think. So yeah, it's, you know, it can be overwhelming sometimes, right? And it seems like, yeah, everything got comped against us. And I think like people don't understand. People are like, hey, like, yeah, if you just make a game with better graphics, like it should have a higher market cap, right? But right, they don't understand like the work that's gone into this, in terms of the community building as well, and the thinking around, you know, the economy and nourishing these content creators and everything, the relationships, social capital in this network. But yeah, I think, you know, we also are, you know, extremely bullish on, and you know, these player owned digital nations, right? That's, you know, that's part of the vision for Ronin, is to be this scalable place for, right, some of the next generation of these experiences.
So of those like 2.5 to 5% of these play to earn game startups, say we're on the other side of this, and like that 5% exists and we see which ones they are, what do you think will be the thing that they needed to have gotten right in order to make it through that filter?
I think it's a combination. It's honestly a combination of things, which I think is what is going to make it so hard. Because some people might get the community rights, and some people might get the economy right, and some people might get the scaling right. Some people might get the art and the gameplay right. But I think putting it all together is right where the magic happens. I think, yeah, Web3 community building. I mean, I'm you know, maybe I'm biased. everyone tends to think what they do is important. So I think Web3 community building is a difficult journey that requires like blood, sweat, and tears, and there are no shortcuts. I think the art, it has to be like the right type of gamer. I think like one of the underappreciated reasons for Axie's success is that people love their Axies. People, right, they feel bad selling their first team of Axies, their first Axies.
The Gemini exchange has been my exchange of choice ever since I got into crypto. I use Gemini to both buy the dips and also manage my regular automatic monthly purchases of my preferred crypto asset. On Gemini, you'll find over 50 different cryptos, including many of the top DeFi and Metaverse tokens like YFI and Axie Infinity. Using Gemini Earn, you can earn yield on your various cryptos, including 8% on the GUSD stablecoin. Gemini is available in all 50 states and more than 50 countries worldwide. So if you're looking to upgrade your crypto exchange, sign up at Gemini with gemini.com/gobankless and get $15 of Bitcoin after you trade $100 or more within the first 30 days. That's gemini.com/gobankless. The Brave browser is the user-first browser for the Web3 internet, with over 50 million monthly active users. Control your digital footprint with built-in privacy and ad blocking. Inside the Brave browser, you'll find the Brave Wallet, the first secure crypto wallet built natively inside of a Web3 crypto browser. Web3 is freedom from big tech and Wall Street, more control and better privacy. But there's a weak point in Web3, your crypto wallet. The Brave Wallet is different. Brave Wallet is built natively inside the Brave browser, no extension required, which gives the Brave Wallet an extra level of security versus other wallets. With the Brave Wallet, you can buy, store, send, and swap your crypto assets, and you can even manage your NFTs and connect to other wallets and DeFi apps, all from the security of the best privacy browser on the market. Whether you're new to crypto or a seasoned pro, it's time to switch to the Brave Wallet. Download Brave at brave.com/bankless and click the wallet icon to get started. Arbitrum is an Ethereum scaling solution that's going to completely change how we use DeFi and NFTs. Over 250 projects have already deployed on Arbitrum, and Arbitrum's DeFi and NFT ecosystems are growing rapidly. Arbitrum increases Ethereum speed by orders of magnitude for a fraction of the cost of the average gas fee. When interacting with Arbitrum, you can get the performance of a centralized exchange while tapping into Ethereum's level of decentralization and security. If you're a developer who wants low gas fees and instant transactions for your users, visit developer.offchainlabs.com to get started building your application on Arbitrum. If you're a user, keep an eye out for your favorite DeFi apps or NFT projects building on Arbitrum. Many of your favorite apps are already live, with many more coming over soon. You can find these apps at portal.arbitrum.1, and you can bridge your assets over to Arbitrum using bridge.arbitrum.io in order to experience DeFi and NFTs the way it was always meant to be. Fast, cheap, and friction-free. So, Jiho, we had this break in the conversation, but we're going to do our best to pick up where we left off. You were talking about how everyone has this like emotional bond to their first team of Axies, and it makes it difficult to sell these Axies, or emotionally difficult is what you were inferring to. And kind of reminds me of a conversation I was having with a DC investor where NFTs, when crypto prices go down significantly, NFTs they're not the first thing that people go to like liquidate when they need to cover their margin positions, which many people in DeFi have. Do you have your own experiences about like your emotional attachments to Axies that you might be able to share?
Sure. So yeah, there are a bunch of Axies that I consider priceless that I would never sell, right? Like my first Axie number 707, right? That was what kind of introduced me to the universe and started my journey, right? Like I bought that thing, I thought it was awesome, and right, just started, I felt like, okay, I'm part of this project now, and I have to start working. So yeah, I think right, like that emotional utility, right? I'm not sure if that's a term, but I think it makes sense, right? It's like there's this emotional utility where right, NFTs don't work if everyone is buying NFTs to try to make money, right? Like it's just the laws of the universe don't work like that, right? There has to be this. Notion that right, you're kind of spending money. There are people who are spending money on NFTs rather than just everyone cannot be an investor, right? Just like yeah, I think we talked about this, right? Like when you buy a Pokemon card, right? You buy a Pokemon card because you just need it, right? Like the fact that there is liquidity for it, right? Like can allow you to justify spending, you know, a large amount. So I think that's a lot of where the future is, and right, like what people need to understand. I think this is also something that we don't do a good job of communicating as a space to the public, right? The public sees this, you know, they see us as right, these degenerates that are right online, right? Like make, and all the headlines are about people making millions of dollars or whatever. And we have to do a better job of communicating, right, the emotional utility, the emotional aspect, the pride and joy of showing off these NFTs. I think that's super important in the education process and you know, expanding the community and getting more people involved.
Has this at all turned into a more like concrete strategy with the future of the Axie ecosystem? It's like you guys are trying to inject emotion into the game.
Yeah, I think things like right, like collector's badges. There was an interesting change that we made where by accident, right, like when Axies were fighting in battle, they stopped making facial expressions, like stopped grimacing or when they're attacking or getting attacked, and that was like a big issue for our players, right? So we realized that, right, like these small little details that make Axie more lifelike. They're really important. So I think Axie, right, like for example, if you log in and you haven't logged in for 2 weeks, right, your Axie should be, right, like acting like a dog or a puppy when you get home after a long break, right? That so I watched a documentary, like, why do we love dogs? Why do humans love dogs? It's not actually because we think that they're cute, right? Because there are actually a lot of people who have dogs that are kind of objectively ugly, and they still love them just as much as, right, dogs that are actually, right, objectively cute, right? And a lot of the reason that people love dogs is because dogs actually love humans. Dogs show love and affection to humans. They reciprocate it. And that's actually what makes us love our dogs the most, right? So basically, in order for people to love their Axies even more, we have to basically create systems where the Axies actually can show affection to their owners. So that was a conversation that I had with like the art team and the animation team, and they seemed really receptive to it. So,
as a developer, that sounds like a really fun project. Hey, make these NFTs, these animated NFTs, make them show love towards the people that own them. And like we could go, like we talked about how like you talked about how the NFT industry doesn't really do a very good job of advertising the emotional bond that people have to their like, you know, NFTs, and the external world just kind of thinks that there's these pixels with price tags. But also, if we really want to optimize for that price tag, we would probably be trying to create NFTs that are more like stronger conduits of love between owner and NFT. Like, this probably would be good for the valuations of these things.
I think so, right? Like, ultimately, yeah, there has to be, right, like a combination of aesthetics, utility, and scarcity. Right. And that's where I think that's where I wrote this about this in, I think, like 2018. Right. It's like the triple threat framework for adding value to NFTs. And yeah, like, you know, I think people kind of understand the scarcity part. They understand the aesthetics. And I think gaming, right, in general is an answer, an attempt to answer, right, like what does true utility for these things look like? So that's, you know, that can be seen as, okay, like you're using these things in a game. But I think it's also, right, like you see these as part of your life. So yeah, it's really important. The virtual beings industry has started reaching out to me a lot over the last year, right? Because I think what they see is, okay, when people think about AI or intelligent characters, right? A lot of people, they think about, okay, like how do we get a hologram or right, like a virtual influencer that, right, like that seems lifelike. But I think, right, even lower hanging fruit is how can you make a virtual pet that is more lifelike? Because the barrier, right, the there's no like Turing test, right? Like with a pet, right? It's a lot easier, I think, to simulate that experience of a real pet than it is to simulate the experience of speaking and interacting with a real human being, I think. So I think the virtual being space or the virtual life space is actually really, really interested in Axie. So yeah, there's definitely some stuff to explore around that as well.
Earlier in the conversation, we were talking about how good games, especially good Web3 games, have migrated from just like trying to serve dopamine on a platter to its players to creating much more realism. And we talked a little bit about like loss, right? Like when you lose in a game, like you should actually have lost something, either monetary value or something scarce, because, you know, there is no joy without loss, right? There is no such thing as one-sided happiness. You have to have sadness to also have happiness. And you also talked about how, like, you know, the working definition for the metaverse is something that is just the digital world, but just trying to replicate our actual world, but in virtual format. And so, like, my mind is going towards like the version of the metaverse where, like, I think the way to onboard people into the metaverse is like find ways to optimize for love, right? Because that's at the end of the day, that's all what people want. Like, you know, we all like some people get trapped in the money game, but really people forget that, you know, money is just, you know, a means to an end. And usually everyone's end is the same thing, which is love. And so maybe that's the alpha for any of the, you know, Web3 game developers here is like, yeah, you're actually trying to build love into your game.
I think, yeah, it's right, like these real emotions, right? It's like, I don't know, what are the hierarchy of needs? What is like ikigai, right? I think like some people, they say that Axie is interesting because, yeah, it operates right at the intersection of what I want to spend my time doing, what I enjoy doing, or what I feel super passionate about. So replicating these, right? Like we talked about, right? The people, they say, oh, like NFT games, they're not fun enough, right? And fun is some kind of like arbitrary ideal. But actually, right? You know, the founder of Eve Online, right? He says like, don't optimize or don't, you know, chase fun as a developer, right? It's like, you actually want to, you know, create professions within your ecosystem, right? Like you want to create a rewarding experience. And I think, right, like, yeah, I think, right, like what we're seeing is that our digital lives are becoming rewarding in the same ways that our physical lives are hard. They're difficult, but we ultimately, most of us find them rewarding in some way or another.
Do you think that software, there's that meme that software is eating the world, right? And now with Ethereum and smart contracts, software is also eating finance for like the first time ever. And there's generally been the pattern that anything that software touches, it generally improves. And so now we have this concept of like the metaverse where software is just straight up eating reality outputting like a different one that perhaps is improved. Like it could get real dystopian, but it could also get real like utopian as well. Like do you think that like do you agree with the trajectory that like software is producing a new version of reality that perhaps is better because that's how we can code for that? We can code it to be better.
I wouldn't. Yeah, it's hard to say better. But what I'll say is right. It I think it's creating this base level of access to ideas, relationships, and communities. Right, where for most of human history, we were forced almost right to basically be a part of the town, the community that we're kind of physically born into, even the nation state. Whereas what we're now seeing are these opt-in nations, opt-in digital nations, opt-in digital communities that are starting to fulfill a lot of the needs and desires of what it means to be a human being. And right, like if you're born into a very difficult situation, I think it provides some opportunity out where, right, you can meet people from anywhere around the world, learn from them, right? You're not just like, you know, being limited to the people and ideas and circumstances of where you're, you know, physically born into. So that's one thing that I'm starting to see, right? And I think it's interesting that, right, the first scalable impact that we've started to see is, right, like, you know, people going crazy over Axie and places like Venezuela and the Philippines, right, where there is, you know, very low access to, right, like, opportunity, ideas, things like that. So.
Well, I think that's a really optimistic version of the future. Obviously, there is the tug of war behind like, well, you know, you can't actually go live in the metaverse. Like, you know, the metaverse will not put food on the table. Only real resources in the real world definitely will. But it's also hard not to be just extremely optimistic of, it's just easier to discover things that you care about on an emotional level because of exactly what you talked about. Like, the internet allows you to go take a beeline for the things that you care about, where if you were born in some, you know, small town population of just like 1,000 people in some like flyover state or some, you know, third world country where like your hobbies that you have can't really be fully expressed, maybe the metaverse allows a more direct route to expressing some of those interests.
And I think, right, like one key point that I think just popped up into my head is it allows you access to people in a direct access almost to people in a different socioeconomic class than you, right? So you could be a Filipino Axie player and you can join a guild and you could meet, right, like, you know, really enlightened Web3, you know, people from all over the world that have been in this space for 6 years and kind of learn from them. And when, right, like when very rich people spend within these, right, digital economies, there's more, right, it's more of a perfect trickle down system, right? For example, right? So if, you know, someone is rich and, you know, just wants a bunch of axes, they're buying axes from the marketplace, that there is, right, like direct value transfer from someone in a developing world spending for fun and to increase their collection to people in emerging markets that are, right, seeing this as a way of ascending in the universe or their kind of like their socioeconomic status. So I think there's more, right? Like this one been one of the I think like the super controversial things, right, about I don't know the last 40 to 50 years of, you know, global macro policy, right, is like, right, like how efficient is this idea of like, right, trickle down economics. And I think we haven't really seen, right, truly efficient mechanisms of having those types of trickle down mechanics actually work, right? Where, you know, arguably when rich people spend in the physical world, a lot of that spending goes to other rich people. Whereas I think in when rich people spend in the digital world, there will be more of that value captured by, people from, people who are, you know, I guess who don't have that much capital.
Mm-hmm. Jiho, what about the future makes you optimistic?
I think that the future is going to be scary. I think the future is going to be actually be more free, and there's actually going to be more responsibility in that. I think like we're starting to see the technologies that will allow us to be, right, more autonomous. But there will also be, right, like a battle. And I think for me, like what I find, like I always felt like I was a revolutionary without, you know, any cause to be involved with. So I think like, right, like if you're that type of person, right, like I think our generation has reason to be optimistic because I think we are a lucky generation in that there will be significant causes to take part in, which is, right, like, right, like some people might feel jealous of people who lived during, like very peaceful eras. I think we're not going to have a peaceful era. I think it's going to be full of conflict and schisms and different ideas. But I think those are the most interesting times to live in. And I think our generation and the people who are involved in this ascension of Web3, we have a chance to be looked back on for generations to come. So it's almost like a generational opportunity that will come with a lot of, it's gonna be hard. But I think, right, like at least we have a cause worth fighting for, which I think some generations didn't have the chance to, like maybe like the baby boomers or something like that. So
I think being adaptable in the 2020s is going to be a very, very important property or characteristic for, you know, making it through this crazy decade, because I also think it's going to be one of volatility and chaos. Any other characteristics come to mind as to what would be useful properties or characteristics, personality traits for people to lean into as they navigate the next decade?
Yeah, so I think like, yeah, open-mindedness, curiosity, yeah, just being open to making friends with anyone anywhere in the world and forming like deep social and kind of economic relationships with people over the internet, right? I think I think like, and then just like being willing to, waste a lot of time online, right, trying to click the right combination of buttons to go down these interesting rabbit holes. I think that's just, you know, the willingness to kind of wander and, right, like some people, are so goal oriented, but I think sometimes you just need to kind of absorb information. So I think having that willingness is also going to be really important.
Jiho, thank you for joining me on this episode of Layer Zero.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.